Great, Tim. Morning, everybody. Lovely to see you. Claire and Nathan and I have just come back from 5 days in Arran. We chose a fairly good week. It's about 4 good days, 1 bad. And yes, I did do goat fell at great personal cost. But it was a good time. But while there, we visited, we were staying very close to a place called Sanox. And we visited Sanox. It's an interesting thing that's going on there. There was a church built there in 1822, and there's a whole piece of history there, which I'll tell you a little bit more about later. But the church has fell into emptiness, as it were, with the Highland clearances, and it's now been bought and the surrounding land, and is being refurbished and reconvened to become Sanox Christian Centre. And there's something fascinating going on there. But the interesting thing was that the church was formed after the visit of the Haldane brothers. And they visited in about 1805, and the church was built in 1822 by a group of disciples of these Haldane brothers. You'll wonder where I'm going with this. Well, more of the Haldane brothers in a little while. But the Haldane brothers were setting Scotland on fire with the gospel and some amazing things that were going on. But they met with some opposition and some difficulty and some struggling against, and this is my point, struggling against the kind of prevailing wind of understanding of what church is and who church was for and so on. And they met opposition and they were somewhat persecuted. They came up against this kind of wall of opposition and difficulty. Anyway, more of them later. But we're going to look at the passage in John chapter 9. You might want to turn there. It's on page, whatever page is it in my Bible, it's 1075. And we're going to work our way through this. And the issue of prevailing winds, as it were, prevailing attitudes, crops up in this. There's a word called Zeitgeist. It's a German word, and I don't really understand it. I think, actually, we've got some Germans here. What's Zeitgeist mean? Is it kind of the spirit of the times, as it were, or, yeah. So it's the kind of prevailing understanding, and the definition of it is that it's the ideas prevalent in a period and place, particularly as expressed in literature, philosophy, and religion. And so that's Zeitgeist. There was an interesting illustration of this. I don't know if any of you saw the film Gandhi. Was it really over 3 hours long, that film? It was an impressive film anyway. And just after there was this appalling atrocity at Amritsar, and Gandhi comes before a group of British bureaucrats and generals in the army, and he simply lays down the ultimatum as to what was to happen with India. And one of the things he says is that India is for the Indians, and the British needed to leave. And you have this stuffy old general who says, but India is British. And he just doesn't get it because he's bought into this kind of prevailing understanding. So you can pick out some of these prevailing understandings as we look at this chapter in John 9. And as we go through it, I've got 3 points. I'm sorry it's only 3. I know some of you would want a lot more, but we're just going to have to make do with 3 points as I go through this. Is that all right? And we'll pick out some of these zeitgeists as we go. The context, very interesting, in chapter 8 of verse 58, verse 58 of chapter 8. Conflict with the Jews. And he says, I tell you the truth, Jesus answered. Before Abraham was born, I am. At this, they picked up stones to stone him. And so Jesus had said there, when he said, before Abraham was born, I am, wasn't simply a claim to be pre-existing Abraham, but he was using the word, the name of God, Yahweh, and it was actually a claim to divinity, which the Jews picked up the stones, you know, we're going to stone you for blasphemy, a man claiming to be God. So that was the context, and now we slip into chapter 9. Verse 1, as he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Zeitgeist. Right there, you have the prevailing understanding of sickness. If somebody's sick, then it's because they've sinned. And if it's not them, then it's their parents. So it's an interesting thing. They're walking along and they see this man born blind. And the disciples ask him, well, whose fault is this? Is it his fault or his parents? A little bit tricky, actually, if it was to be his fault because he was born blind. So when did he sin? Was that in the womb that he sinned? You get yourself into a bit of a fankle here. And so they thought, well, no, but it must be his parents. And Hindus would probably add an extra one. It's probably because of karma, you know, the benefit or the punishment of what's happened in an earlier life. And Jesus says, no, none of those. None of those. He says, neither this man nor his parents sinned, Jesus said. But this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. I thought about that. The work of God might be displayed in his life. I'm sorry, by the way, if you wanted me to read this all the way through in once, I'm not. We're just going to go walk our way through this. I thought about that. What was the work of God going to be displayed in his life? Was it going to be that he would endure his difficulty with grace and the help of God, as some of us are called to do with some of the difficulties we experience? Or was it going to be in this miraculous healing that came? My guess is that in his case, it was because of the miraculous healing, which was about to happen. This happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it's day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. Ooh, he'd said that before, actually. While I'm in the world, I am the light of the world. So he's challenging the kind of cultural understanding of illness. And now there's something else that goes on. It probably challenges our understanding of what's proper. Something really weird happens here. Having said this, he spat on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. I mean, it's bad enough being blind, as somebody said, but to have the spit on and mud put on your eyes, that's another problem as well, isn't it? But that's what happened. Go, he told him, wash in the pool of Siloam. This word means sent. So the man went and washed and came home seeing. Amazing transformation of that man's life. Can you imagine it when he gets home? When he goes into possibly his parents' house, we don't quite know. I mean, they understood him to be begging. He was out begging. He's probably dirty. And he goes in and says, hi, Mum. And she says, how'd you get on with the begging today? He says, oh, well, not too bad. Had a couple of oranges and a piece of bread, and my eyes were sorted. Oh, good. What are we going to be doing tomorrow? You know, an ordinary day. No, the man was healed. He was born blind. He had never seen in his life. And now he has transformed. His whole life experience is going to be totally different because of what Jesus had done there. It challenges us. I don't know why Jesus spat on the mud and put it on his eyes. And there's no hint of understanding. Some people say that spit had some kind of healing properties. We don't like that in our sophisticated and antiseptic-laden culture, do we? But some people believe that. Maybe the idea of the mud was the kind of ground from which we're made, as it were. We just don't know. We just don't know. But that's what happened, and he did it on the Sabbath. So it's interesting, the reaction. Verse 8, his neighbors and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg? Some claimed that he was. He probably was looking different because he's now clean. Others said, no, he only looks like him. But he himself insists, I am the man. How then were your eyes opened, they demanded. He replied, the man they call Jesus made some mud, put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see. Where is this man? They asked him. I don't know, he said. And their reaction is fascinating. We get more of that in my second point in a moment or two. But it's kind of like, this is rather interesting. A man born blind healing. So where was it? What kind of mud was it? How much water did he add? You know, it's kind of like we need to investigate this. We're not even bothering to say, wow, this is incredible. We ought to celebrate this. But they're saying, we need to check this out. The healing. And just in case you think that healing is confined to the pages of this and into the ministry of Jesus, I thought I'd read you something that a friend Lawrence sent to me just a few months ago. Lawrence and I went to Kampala, to Uganda, a few years ago. And he has a wonderful ministry, but and he goes regularly. And in his letter to me, he sent this. He said, I want to tell you of Miriam, who I prayed for on my first visit in 1997. She was an 11-year-old girl who was seriously deformed, and the team prayed for her again the following year. We were all depressed that we were unable to see any change. Since then, I've visited a patch two or three times and inquired about her, only to be met by blank looks. However, this last Easter, I was preaching at St. Thomas's again and was approached by the treasurer, who thanked the team for praying for his firstborn, who was healed. Further questions revealed that this was Miriam who he was talking about, and I drew out the full story. This is what happened. When the team prayed, she felt a cool breeze overcome her, and warmth and strength soon followed. Within 4 days, she was completely healed, with arms and legs straight and functioning normally. Her digestive problems stopped, as did her nightmares. Yes. Wonderful. This is what Jesus does. The blind man, this episode, this is what Jesus does. He brings sight to the blind, literally and spiritually, metaphorically too. This is what Jesus does. I am the light of the world, he says. Here's what he does. So that's the miracle, that's the healing. So the inquiry, point two, if you're counting. This is what dead religion does. It's quite a contrast here. Let's read some of it. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Uh-oh. He shouldn't have done it then. He could have waited until the Monday or the Tuesday, but he did it on the Sabbath. So they were very concerned about that because they had strict rules about the Sabbath. And therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he'd received his sight. He put mud on my eyes, the man replied, and I washed and now I see. Would you look up mud pies, please? I can just imagine them kind of leafing through. You know, what's it say about the Sabbath rules about making mud pies? Sorry, we don't have anything under M nor under P, but it is work. And it's on the Sabbath, therefore he's a sinner. Some of the Pharisees said, verse 16, this man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath. Zeitgeist. Again, we've got it. He just hit it head on. He didn't do it on the Monday or the Tuesday or the Wednesday or Thursday or Friday. He did it on the Sabbath, and Jesus hit it straight on because he was challenging the prevailing understanding, the prevailing attitude of how people saw things. But others asked, how can a sinner do such miraculous signs? So they were divided. Verse 17, finally they turned again to the blind man. Well, what have you got to say about him? It was your eyes that he opened. And the man replied, probably venturing as much as he could, he's a prophet. The Jews still did not believe that he had been blind and had received his sight until they sent for the man's parents. Is this your son? They asked. Lost my place. Is this your son, they asked? Is this the one you say was born blind? How is it that he can now see? It's just such a fascinating thing. They're getting themselves in an incredible fankle here. We want, you know, okay, so he can see, but it was mud and he was working. Well, actually, was he really blind from birth? You know, we need to check this out properly. We need to know, because at the back of it, they really weren't at all interested in finding out who Jesus was. They were interested in finding a way to condemn him and resist his whole message. Verse 20, we know he's our son, the parents answered, and we know he was born blind, but how he can now see or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him, he is of age. He will speak for himself. Verse 22, and here we see the real motivation about what was going on. His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, he's of age, ask him. So they really weren't all that interested in who Jesus was or in the miracle. They simply wanted to make sure nobody was accepting that Jesus was the Christ. And the threat was they'd be put out of the synagogue and all of the cultural ramifications of that within that society. I was amused a couple of months ago when I happened to notice, I was reading something, and I happened to notice the whole issue of divergence of opinions and whether divergent opinions are allowed. Did you know that in 1539, King Henry VIII, who was basically the thought police of the time, he passed an act called the Abolishing of Diversity of Opinions. Can you imagine that? You are not allowed to disagree. It's what's going on. And it was the six fundamental Catholic doctrines, as was known as the Act of Six Articles. You have to agree with me, and if you don't agree with me, you'll be punished. Zeitgeist. See, that's what's going on. And don't think that our culture and our day doesn't have similar prevailing winds of attitudes. They are around, and they're coming in, and they affect us, and they affect our thinking in different ways. And dead religion, which is what's going on here with the Pharisees, wants to, it's from an opposing force, and it wants to persecute and stamp out any of the life of Christ which comes and shows itself. That's what dead religion does. It persecutes the life from God. Now, I promised you a little bit more about the Haldanes. I picked up the book, The Haldane Brothers. I don't know if any of you know of or read any of this, but I was absolutely staggered as I picked up this book and read it. They lived and worked, two brothers, James and Robert, and they took Scotland by storm. Having become Christians, they were in the Navy, and then they became Christians, and they took Scotland by storm, having become completely devoted to Christ. And they were going all over the place. This is the kind of late 1700s and early 1800s. And so here's just a few little samples. Going all over Scotland, preaching to over 600 people from the steps of the church in Elgin, onto Nairn, Forres, and Focarbers, preaching to gatherings of 700 to 1,000 people. Typically, this is in the open air because the church wouldn't let them in. Went to the Orkneys for 10 days and preached 55 times, remarkable gatherings. On returning to Kirkwall, James preached several times to 4,000 to 600 people. There was just something amazing going on, which, you know, from where we are in our culture, we eat our hearts out about those kind of numbers and that kind of response to the gospel that there was then. So, and then lay preaching. Lay preaching had become a big issue in the established Church of Scotland. The question is, who confers authority to preach? Many supported James and his colleagues in their work, whilst others condemned. The whole of Scotland was being moved by the Spirit of God, and it was clear to see that something was happening. And what was the established church wanting to do? Well, this is what they do. They meet in the General Assembly, and they issue a bull. Once I can find the place. 4,000 copies of a bull issued by the assembly to be read in all churches throughout the land, prohibiting all peoples not licensed to preach to desist forthwith. Because James and Robert were not licensed to preach. Yet they were turning the whole nation upside down. And the established church, the dead religion as it was at that time, perhaps not all of it, wanted to say, this has got to stop. In fact, they even wanted an act of parliament that would stop this. This is what dead religion does. Now, contrast that. This is what Jesus does. He heals, he gives sight to the blind, he gives enlightenment, he gives understanding. He makes people whole. And what does dead religion do? It persecutes, and it condemns, and it restricts and constrains. That's what's going on. And all the man says, verse 25, just such a powerful testimony. Verse 25, he simply replied, whether he's a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see. What a statement. I was blind, but now I see. There was something that was just incontrovertible about that. He could see, and Jesus had done it, and it makes such a transformation. He answered, I've told you already. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples again yourselves? And I have to admire this former blind man, because he's just speaking to these people with such a conviction. And he even says, well, why do you keep going on about this? I was blind, now I can see. Do you want to become his disciple? And that was another uh-oh moment. He should not have said that. He should not have said that. Then they hurled insults at him, verse 28, and said, you are this fellow's disciple. We're disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses. But as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from. The man answered, oh, that's remarkable. I can just see the kind of manner of this man. That's remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. Come on, join the dots. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to godly men, a godly man who does his will. Nobody ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Well, that just tipped the balance for them. They'd had it by then. To this they replied, you were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us? And they threw him out. That's what dead religion does. He appealed to them. You know, come on, make the conclusion. I was blind, now I see. Who does it? What kind of person does that? Join the dots. But they were having none of it. They were resistant to it. Zeitgeist. There's a cost. There's a cost for that man. That's my second point. If you're counting, the third point, the culmination. Verse 35. Jesus heard that they'd thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, really sorry you were thrown out of the synagogue. That doesn't say that, actually. Really sorry they treated you badly. Doesn't say that either. He says, do you believe in the Son of Man? Do you believe in the Son of Man? He asks the man, the former blind man, do you believe in the Son of Man? Now, the Son of Man was an interesting term. It's a term that Jesus used frequently to describe himself and what he was doing. You know, the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. You'll see the Son of Man coming, etc. The Son of Man was a term which wasn't saying, I'm the Christ, overtly, but it's a term that he was able to invest with meaning over 3 years. And yet it actually was a loaded statement, because if you go back to the prophecy in Daniel, where the term Son of Man first occurs, that there it says, a Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All nations and peoples of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. The Son of Man, when you unravel it, was a window into an understanding of Jesus that sees him as God, sees him as coming with power and authority, and that he will be worshipped by everyone, every nation. So the term Son of Man was a window into that. And it's curious, I find, that the man is asked, do you believe in the Son of Man? And we don't know whether he understood the term properly or not, but he simply says, who is he, sir? And the man asked, tell me so that I may believe in him. Verse 37, Jesus said, you have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you. Now note what happens. Verse 38. Then the man said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. This is the culmination. This is the climax. This is the thing that not only gives the person his sight back, but changes his whole life and his own future. I believe. And he worshipped him. And Jesus says, for judgment I come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. Don't you find it fascinating in this dialogue, in this narrative, that the blind man sees and the Pharisees who could see are actually getting themselves in such a fankle that they were essentially blind. They were blind. And that's what's going on here. Jesus says, for judgment I come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind. So the question is, bringing this to a conclusion, where are we in this? Where are we in this? In our own internal life, where are we? If Jesus asks us the question, personally and directly, do you believe in the Son of Man? Do you believe in the Christ? What do we say? What do we say this morning? Are we still checking it out, as it were? Or are we caught up with our own cultural zeitgeists? For us, do we have a sophisticated skepticism that likes to ask questions but not have answers? To live being witty and cynical, but have no convictions. To stand at the edge, but never enter in to relationship with Christ. See, that's part of our culture. We like being cynical. We're a very cynical culture. And it avoids us having convictions. So is that where we are? A sophisticated skepticism. And Jesus says, well, what do you think? What do you think? Who is the blind person? Is it those who acquiesce to the pervasive assumptions of our culture? Is it those who drift with values and political correctness of a secular atheism? Or is it those who choose to put their trust in Christ? Who is the blind person here? Jesus asked the blind man that question, do you believe in the Son of Man? Jesus was always asking questions. He asked the disciples, who do the people say that I am? And a whole load of answers came out from the different disciples, from Peter. And he says, but who do you say that I am? And you know, we all have to answer that question sooner or later. We all have to answer the question, who do you say that Jesus is? Are you teetering at the edge? Or have you actually made up your mind? Are you more comfortable asking the questions and never reaching a conclusion than actually making a decision and choosing, as this former blind man did, to actually recognize and worship Christ? Have you made that decision? It is a choice. I know we need lots of information, but it is a choice that we make. And what do we choose? Do we choose with the Pharisees just to be an inquisitor? Or do we choose with the blind man to actually respond and worship? I made that choice when I was 19 years old, and I've had to live that out over many years now. And many of us have made that choice. And I'm not wanting to be too precipitative here, but there is a choice that we can make that takes us from the edge and from cynicism and from skepticism into life and into sight, into enlightenment. What do you choose this morning? In about 10 seconds, I'm going to pack up and sit down, and John is going to come and lead us in to our concluding song. While I do that, why don't you just choose now?